I'd like to call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee on February 23rd to order. Chair Liebling is presenting a bill in the Commerce Committee this afternoon, so I will be chairing the first part of the meeting. Today we will have presentations from DHS on a bill from Representative Richardson. Our first item of business is to have the clerk take the roll. Krista, can you please take the roll?
Yes. Chair Liebling, excused. Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Present. Representative Schumacher, excused. Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Backer.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen. Representative Keel. Representative Keel.
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen's here.
Okay, Grunhagen present. Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Quam. Representative Quam. Representative Ryer.
Present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
Quorum is present. Today, I'm sorry, gotta get my right space here. We need to approve the minutes of the February 22nd meeting. Representative Ryer, have you read the minutes?
Yes, I have. I move that they are adopted.
Ask approval of the minutes for February 22nd. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Next, we will move on. Sorry, I already did that. Our first presentation will be a presentation from DHS on their proposal in the governor's budget of making changes to the non-emergency transportation system in Minnesota. Assistant Commissioner Matt Anderson will be presenting for DHS. Mr. Anderson?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
We can, Mr. Anderson.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Happy to be here to talk with you today about our non-emergency medical transportation benefit and some changes that are included in the governor's proposed budget. Next slide. Just for some context setting, non-emergency medical transportation covers transportation for our enrollees to any medically necessary service using the most appropriate and least costly mode of transportation. So this is a benefit that's covered both in our medical assistance or Medicaid population. It also covers individuals who are under 19 years of age in our Minnesota Care population. Next slide. When we talk about non-emergency medical transportation, we're really talking about a broad range of different types of transportation. Our clients are offered the least costly but most appropriate mode of transportation for their needs. We start with mode one, and through an assessment based on the physical and cognitive abilities of the enrollee, we assess whether they have access to a personal vehicle or public transportation and move up in the options until appropriate transportation is found to meet their needs. Now, some of the less obvious types of transportation that we have here, unassisted is referring to really what we would consider to be sort of a taxi cab kind of experience where a vehicle picks up a person at their home, the car waits out at the curb, the person goes to the car, it drops them off at their appointment. This also includes public transportation. Assisted transportation provides assistance for individuals either because of their cognitive or physical limitations, where the driver or the provider would go to the door of the home, help that person get into the vehicle, and then when they get to their medical appointment, help the person out of the vehicle and into the facility to make sure that they get to where they need to be for their appointment. Protected transportation is our newest mode of transportation. It's also our least used mode of transportation. It's really designed to help transport individuals who are experiencing a mental health crisis. And it's a way as an alternative to having them transported by law enforcement, which could actually exacerbate their crisis. And so it's trying to give a different means of transportation for those individuals. Next slide. These services are not exactly part of the non-emergency medical transportation benefit, but they're coordinated and administered jointly with it. These benefits are only allowed in certain situations. So, for example, someone has to be gone from home a certain number of hours before they would be eligible to be reimbursed for meals. Or lodging is only allowed if it's cost effective to pay for the lodging rather than the back and forth trips. But because they are administered together, we wanted to note those for the committee's background. Next slide. Within our non-emergency transportation, we have different ways that the program is administered. So today, for enrollees in managed care, the managed care organizations administer that benefit for their members. One exception to that is managed care organizations are prohibited from making payments directly to their enrollees. So for personal mileage reimbursement or meals reimbursement or parking reimbursement, all of those reimbursements that would go directly to the enrollee, those are administered by the county instead of the managed care plan. But otherwise, when you think of managed care and non-emergency medical transportation, that health plan is administering the benefit for its enrollees. In our fee-for-service programs, the administration of the program is split between counties and the state. So the counties administer modes 1 through 4, or those lower level modes of transportation. Counties enroll and pay providers. They set the procedures for their members in their counties to access those services. For the higher level modes of transportation, those are administered by the state. So the state enrolls and pays providers. We have a vendor that we contract with to do the level of need assessments for enrollees for those services and manage it through that. Next slide. So the proposal in Governor Walz's budget is to create a uniform administrator of non-emergency medical transportation to really consolidate the benefits under a single administrator with a single point of contact for enrollees. So the proposal would include both our medical assistance and Minnesota Care enrollees. It would include both our fee-for-service and managed care populations, and it could be administered on a statewide basis or a regional basis. The genesis for this proposal really began back in 2017. The Federal Office of Inspector General performed an audit of our non-emergency medical transportation services and found that 75% of the rides did not comply with either state or federal requirements, mostly due to one of three reasons. Either there was a lack of sufficient documentation about the ride and about the transport, there wasn't any documentation at all, or the auditor was unable to find a medical service that the person received that would have justified coverage for the ride. As a result of that audit, DHS returned $1.9 million to the federal government. A similar audit was performed by the Minnesota Office of Inspector General and found similar results. This audit also showed that having a coordinator administering the program increased the likelihood that the transport was provided appropriately. So this proposal that Governor Walz put forward in his proposed budget would streamline the administration of the program on two fronts. First, it would allow for greater economies of scale by combining all of the non-emergency medical transportation under one administrator, and so you'd have more rides and larger volumes. And second, we would be providing our enrollees in the current program who find it difficult to navigate between who they're supposed to call for what types of rides. We would be able to give them a single one-call experience for any of their non-emergency medical transportation needs, whether they're in fee-for-service or managed care, whether the mode of transportation would otherwise have been administered by the county or the state. It would just be one call and the rides would be taken care of. Next slide. I also want to mention another aspect of the governor's proposed budget, another proposal in there, and that is to allow for purchase of bus passes, monthly bus passes when they're available for our enrollees. This proposal is really driven by the need to figure out how we can use our Medicaid and Minnesota Care programs to go further upstream to address social determinants of health that are driving a lot of the health issues and quality of life for our enrollees. We know that one of the most significant social determinants of health and serves as a barrier to accessing care as well as other life needs is transportation. And so what this proposal would do is take our current program, which does allow for people to get a monthly transportation pass, but only if the number of rides and the cost of rides they will need for medical appointments would be at least or greater than the cost of the monthly bus pass. What this proposal would do would take away that cost effectiveness test and basically say, if you're an enrollee and you're gonna need transportation for one service in a month, that you'd be that the program would be able to get a monthly pass, transportation pass for you. And I wanna clarify at the outset, this does not preclude anyone from receiving other modes of transportation based on their needs. So the other, all seven modes of transportation would still be available, would still be an assessment to determine what's most appropriate and least costly. And it wouldn't require anyone who's not served by public transportation to use this mode of service. That wouldn't accomplish our objectives. It also, if someone is living in an area that doesn't have public transportation, obviously it wouldn't apply to them as well. So this is a step to being able to say, not only would we be able to provide transportation to those medically necessary services, but by providing a monthly pass, we would also be providing transportation to jobs, childcare, the pharmacy, grocery stores, what have you, all of which enhance the person's quality of life and ultimately their health. So with that, I will take questions on either proposal if the committee has questions. Mr. Chair, turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Keel, do you have a question or are you signifying you are here?
How about both?
Would you mind if we hold questions till the second presenter, please?
That would be just fine.
And Representative Grunhagen, you're okay with that too?
Yes, I'm fine.
Thank you. Mr. Diogo Hans, I'm sorry if I messed your name up here. I know you as Mr. Reese most of the time, but if you wouldn't mind pronouncing your name and giving us your title, please. Is he here?
Mr. Chair, Diogo Hayes. Yep, he's here. There he is.
Sorry, apologies. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair members. I am here just to answer technical questions if needed. Mr. Anderson, Mr. Anderson covered the presentation for it.
All right, thank you, sir. So I guess we can move to questions. So Representative Keel, you had your hand up first. We're going to go with you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I have some real concerns about this program. My understanding is that this has been tried three different times, and DHS was actually supposed to implement a program that has never been done. Now, this is before I was in, I think I was in the legislature, but not in Health and Human Services, so I understand not quite as much about this, and this is something I learned just in the last hour. But my concern when I look at the non-emergency medical transportation. I live in northwestern Minnesota. My services provide for at least seven counties. I also have Tri-Valley Opportunity Council that does bus people that can go to an appointment scheduled. They don't need any help generally with this, but I'm very concerned financially. We're not going to have that service. And I find it interesting with COVID that we would even suggest that somebody ride together for a dialysis machine ride. However, I know with immunizations and such that they probably will be in a better situation. But we're talking about, the gentleman told me that because the doctors are overloaded, that these rides that were an hour, maybe two, are now becoming 5 hours. He's running out of staff. The costs of this program that now exist, we need to have a bill that funds these guys better. But we need these services. I don't know. My ambulance services are not going to be able to provide all the stretcher transport because of the volunteers and the situation there. I just don't see the mode 4 and 3, 4 and 5 can be provided by my NEMTs now, and I don't know who would be doing that. So is it Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Anderson, how would you suggest that would even happen in Northwestern Minnesota with the services that we have now?
Thank you, Representative Real. Mr. Commissioner? I'm sorry, Mr. Commissioner.
That's okay. I've been called a lot worse. Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, essentially what we would anticipate is that the under this proposal, the administrator or in the region of your state is going to contract with largely the same providers that are providing the services now. And in areas where those services are already limited and where the available providers are limited, I don't think there's going to be significant change in who will be delivering those services and who the contractor will be working with. But instead of those providers having to negotiate and work with 2, 4, up to 7 different managed care organizations and the county and the state, they would be working with one entity and being able to process their claims and arrange for rides through that one entity.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. I guess I'm having a hard time with, if this wasn't successful before, why we're going back to it. And also, I just learned that 20 years ago, 40 years ago, they were seeing about $22 a ride. There's some more detail in there, and now they're receiving 18. So they've gone backwards. The NEMTs have gone backwards in being reimbursed. And my information has said that the insurance companies actually increased the funds just to keep them going, during COVID, so that they were able to actually provide those. And with gas going up, gas has gone up 50 cents, over 50 cents now up here, and, insurance, rate increase for their vehicles, that it's going to be real hard for them to meet those finances. So then my understanding is that you'll be covering all of that, so that there is a, I'm having a hard time understanding how this is working. So maybe it's just me, but very concerned that we could lose these services altogether. And I know we have a lot of volunteer transportation, but we do not have adequate for the miles that need to be taken. So I don't know if you can assure me that they will, the businesses that exist now will actually be able to be funded appropriately. Can you?
Representative Keel, Mr. Anderson, can you answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, I certainly can't speculate about any given business and its financial sustainability. We know that there have been challenges, certainly during COVID. We have worked with our managed care organizations and encouraged them to use the flexibility they have available to adjust rates to providers, to recognize for potential lost revenues or increased costs because of COVID. We also have, and we take very seriously our obligation as stewards of public resources, and when we have audit findings that show significant rates of non-compliance with the requirements for being able to be reimbursed, we need to find ways to be able to address that. And this is one of the ways that we think we have a better chance of being able to get better compliance. The other thing I would note is that there are regions of the state today where counties are using their own administrator in managing this program and doing so successfully. There are all kinds of different variations around the country of different ways. This is a difficult benefit to manage, and there continues to be experimentation around what are the best ways to be able to do this. Situations in the past that have occurred have swung the pendulum in different directions as we try to respond and make sure that we're meeting the needs of our enrollees in the best way possible. And this is a situation where we've had changes in how we have administered it, and we continue to see compliance issues. And so as we are, and as the Blue Ribbon Commission that examined this strategy, looking at ways to reduce spending, increase compliance, and make sure that our enrollees are able to have access to the services that we need. We think this is a proposal that can help us achieve those goals.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I'm gonna move forward to Representative Grunhagen at this point.
Oh, thank you, Chair Hewitt. Yeah, Representative Keel asked some of the questions I had too, especially in the rural area. And you know, if it's been tried before, according to what Representative Keel asked, what were the results then and why are we going back to it now? Then I have another question.
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I don't know. I haven't been at DHS long enough to know exactly what the results were in the past. There have been different situations where the state has moved to a single broker kind of arrangement. The idea in this situation would be to hold that contract closer for the state, and also to be able to consider using regional contracts as opposed to a statewide contract. But those would be details that we'd work out after legislation was passed.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. One more question, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Hewitt. Yeah, I mean, if 75% of the rides are not comply with state and federal requirements, if I remember right, there were also some TV investigative on this. And do you know how much savings there would be or projected by going to this model? And also, could those savings be applied to increasing some of the reimbursement rates in the rural area, where they're just barely scraping by?
Mr. Anderson?
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, you're correct. We will as this proposal moves forward, we will do a fiscal note to get a more accurate picture of the projected savings. When the Blue Ribbon Commission looked at this proposal, it was not doing fiscal notes, but had, you know, sort of a rough fiscal estimate, and that was before COVID. We know that COVID has changed the landscape significantly, and so we'd like the opportunity to be able to do a more current fiscal note before we pin a specific number on it. But absolutely, the legislature would have the ability, if there are savings that are generated, to reinvest those savings in provider rates if it chose to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Grunhagen, I'm going to move on. I'm worried about our schedule here, and I don't want to fail my chair. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe the assistant commissioner could review the OLA report or audit on this topic if he needs background on some of the issues that we have seen and come across in the past. I'd like a little bit of clarification, because my understanding over the last 5-6 years, the total number of entities, and these would be small independent entities across the state that have been put onto the list of, you know, we're not going to use them because they had excluded group providers list. There are 20 in the last, 6 years, which is in the single digit percent of providers. So what is the major driver that you're seeing, or say you're seeing, issues and fraud to do this major change? And then back on your comment about, well, some counties are directly coordinating, at least in those counties, they know the cities, the highways, and the people more directly than a regional or statewide would. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, the issues that we are seeing in terms of compliance remain largely what we saw in the Federal Office of Inspector General report from 2017, lack of documentation, lack of compliance with rules, including drivers who do not have a driver's license, those kinds of issues, or not identifying which vehicle was used for the ride, not having a medical appointment tied to the ride, and those kinds of issues. And we have a current audit that's underway. We can't, we're still reviewing the results of that and still working with providers to make sure that we have correct information about that. But it's mostly around issues around documentation and sufficiency of following the rules. They're not necessarily allegations of fraud or convictions of fraud such that a provider would be put on the excluded list, but it does reflect whether or not payments were actually owed under the terms of our programs.
Representative Kwan, a quick follow-up?
Yes. So my understanding is that we're looking at repeating, you know, going back outside again, because the department and agencies are not capable of maintaining guidance to the federal requirements on this program. And if you aren't capable of doing that to this small section of program, how can we be sure that you're any more capable on all the other programs that are funded through the federal government that require due diligence? In other words, it's not making me feel comfortable. You're saying we can't do it, we're going to have to find someone else, when this is such a small part of your pie for other programs. So maybe the committee could get some details on these type of issues in other programs that the agency and departments are overseeing. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you, Representative Kwan. And I know this will not be the last time we visit this subject. I know this space all too well, and I'm sure we're going to look into it more. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen asked my question virtually word for word. So well done, sir, about would the savings then be used to improve rates? Because to me, that's one of our root cause issues in many areas of healthcare, is that some of these services that we need so badly don't get enough compensation to keep the lights on. I also wanted to make an observation that I often hear not in this committee, but here and elsewhere, we've tried that, it didn't work, why would we try it again? And I would argue that in my career in process improvement and project management, if we didn't keep trying and innovating, we would be permanently stuck in a place where we aren't growing, we aren't finding better ways. The real problem is if you just keep trying and doing things the same way over and over again, which I don't hear suggested here. So I'm just putting in a voice for innovation, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I did want to go back and understand better what we're talking about when I'm talking about the audit reports, that things were not properly documented. And so where was that issue coming up? Because as you know, it's the the counties or the different, the fee for service, you know, where was it happening that there was not the documentation that was required by the federal government for this transportation? And if Commissioner Anderson could address that again one more time and just kind of highlight where that breakdown was. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And Mr. Anderson, we're right on schedule here. Please keep me on time. Can you do it quickly?
I will do my best, Mr. Chairman. All of our providers across our services are required to document the services that they deliver and meet those documentation requirements in order to be able to be reimbursed. So in non-emergency medical transportation, this is really the providers that are delivering the rides that have requirements in state law as to what they have to document and to be able to demonstrate that they are actually delivering the ride, that they're doing it safely, that the patient is getting to the appropriate location, and to be able to have the oversight that we need to have in that. One of the challenges, because it is a small program and because it's been fractured into oversight by managed care, by counties, by the state, it becomes very difficult to, in real time, to be able to oversight of those, which is why we have the audits that we do and that we go and do spot checks and survey to make sure that the documentation is being done. When we get into situations like this where repeated audits show a large percentage of failure to comply with those requirements, that's when we have situations where we feel like we can't just turn a blind eye. We have to be able to do something to make sure that we are overseeing the program the way that we need to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Pryor.
Yep, and so then my understanding then is you have the providers and then there's this layer between you and the providers, and the breakdown is you're trying to do the oversight, but there's a layer between you and the providers, and you know that there is an issue and to get the proper within that layer so that you're not getting the proper is what I understood. So thank you for that further explanation.
So hearing that, I'd like to thank our two testifiers today, and we are moving on to our next bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson, for your time today. Our next bill is House File 1268. This is Representative Richardson's bill. I would like to move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance bill. Representative Richardson, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, Chair.
Nice to see you. Representative Richardson, will you please present your bill?
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. House File 1268 is focused on supporting healthy prenatal development and healthy development of infants. In Minnesota, we know that we continue to have persistent and unacceptable health disparities in infant mortality and morbidity. We have heard the heartbreaking statistics that in this state, Black and Indigenous infants are more than twice as likely to die than white infants before their first birthday. Despite the long-standing racial disparities in infant mortality and morbidity, public attention has only been recently focused on this issue as a public health crisis. This bill would provide a one-time appropriation to the African American Babies Coalition to implement a community-based and led initiative to implement training, education, and best practices for healthy prenatal and postnatal development, particularly for communities with the greatest infant mortality and morbidity disparities. Today, I have with me Samira Bilal-Robi with the African American Babies Coalition, Nidra Robinson with Simpson Housing as a testifiers, and Dominique McQueary with Wilder is also available for questions.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Is Ms. Robinson available?
Yes, I'm here.
Robinson, welcome to the committee. You're first on my list, so I would love to hear your testimony.
Well, my name is Nidra Robinson, and I'm the Early Childhood Program Manager for Simpson Housing Services, and also a founding member and trainer for the African American Babies Coalition. So I've seen work since its inception. It's well known that trauma, stress, and systemic racism have adverse effects on mothers and children, especially our African American and Native American women. But we also know that when people know better, they do better. And that's often the mantra that you will hear within the African American Babies Coalition. The work of the coalition is important because it comes from a grassroots effort of African-American women to support, mentor, and coach other African-American women about maternal health, parenting practices, and overall child health. We train within our community for our community. Because of my work with the Simpson Housing Services, I see on a daily basis what poverty and inequities in healthcare does to young Black mothers. Education through culturally relevant training with nurturing and compassionate trainers is one of our best defenses. A quick example of the powerful work of the African American Baby Coalition is a collaboration between the coalition and Simpson Housing. We held a Mother's Day of Healing for our mothers in our supportive housing program. This was a special all-day retreat for these parents that included speakers highlighting the importance of prenatal and maternal health and building resilience. Small group sessions encouraged creativity and healing. Through our community-based trainings, African-American mothers learn about supporting babies' brain development, strategies that they will use to overcome stress and improve their health, and how to self-advocate in the healthcare process. It's exciting for me as a trainer, and as I've done trainings, to actually see through our discussions that young Black parents are learning the importance of high quality and consistent prenatal and maternal care. I strongly support House File 1268. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. And I'm new at this, so I'm gonna ask you to say your full name and your title for the record.
Okay, thank you. Nedra, N-E-D-R-A, Robinson, R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N, and I'm the Early Childhood Program Manager for Simpson Housing Services.
Thank you, Mrs. Robinson. And Representative Richardson, you have one more testifier, I see.
That is correct.
And may I call, this
Chair,
is going to be a...
Chair, Samir Bilal-Roby.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Are you available?
I certainly am.
And I'm going to do this right this time. Can you say your record, can you say your name and your title for the record? Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Samir Bilal-Roby. I am the director of Wilder African American Babies Coalition and Projects.
Thank you, and you can continue with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name again is Samir Bilal-Roby. I'm the director of the Wilder African American Babies Coalition and Projects and program manager for the Integrated Care High Risk Pregnancy Initiative. I'm also, on a personal note, a grandmother of 19. Wilder AABC works to meet the needs of all our families. Our interest and my passion presented today is the continuation of our work with focused on teens, prenatal health, and training healthcare workers. Through our programming, we address adverse childhood experiences by training the workforce in culturally relevant care through evidence-based training designed from experts in the healthy development. This creates new pathways of health for the entire family. Our concentration, especially right now, is on the human factors related to health and personal interactions with emerging health issues and stress related to COVID-19. My focal point today is on the Black and Indigenous and communities of color with an evidence-based fact. The stress of poverty has the profound indication of disrupted brain development in infants and mental inhibition in adults who are worrying about their finances and the lack of spending crucial time with their families. There lies the problem of social determinants of health, unsafe environments for teens, women, and babies. Fathers living with depression, worrying about their families, often leading to mental health disturbances for all of the above. In passing Bill 1268, we will be able to expand and deepen our work at AABC. We believe we can benefit as a community by paving the way for all families by acknowledging their circumstances and letting them know they're not alone. This allows us to recognize some triggers which bring out inappropriate behaviors, letting them overcome barriers and learn the everyday essentials of care for a vibrant social life. In closing, I call on you to help pass this bill so that our women, babies, and parents can flourish, providing the attention needed to build healthy human beings. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. And I want to thank both the testifiers today. This is such an important subject, and it's great to see that they have such strong advocates as both you two. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate Ms. Robinson and Ms. Bilal-Roby, your testimony. Given that we have really a crisis of maternal and infant mortality in Minnesota, I'm glad to see this bill go forward. I'm sorry it's a one-time appropriation, but I think that reflects the urgency of our need to address this issue. So I'm grateful for the ideas, and I'm grateful for the bill, and I urge support from everyone on the committee. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Are there any other questions from committee members? As not seeing any, it looks like, as the chair, I'll renew my motion that 1268 be put for possibility inclusion on the finance bill. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So it looks like committee, we have another presentation and we're ahead of schedule. Tina's gonna be happy. I mean, she's gonna be proud of me. So our presenters now, let's see what we're at here. Looks like our presented from DHS, a report on telemedicine. We have two presenters this afternoon. It looks like starting with Deputy Assistant Commissioner Julie Marcourt. Are you here?
Yep, Mr. Chair, I am.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Marcourt. You can go ahead with your testimony if you will.
Okay. I'll wait till the slides come up here. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Neerja Singh and I, who's going to come in partway through here to finish up. As everybody knows, we ended up in an unprecedented situation where we had to create rapid response to an emerging and uncertain pandemic. So we're all familiar with the fact that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services allowed states to submit waivers to respond to the peacetime emergency. And so DHS took several steps to ensure that enrollees on our medical assistance and Minnesota care programs could continue to receive necessary care, and allowing that care to accommodate the stay-at-home orders and the social distancing requirements that we now found ourselves facing. And so in order to do that, we took a series of steps to submit waivers to CMS and to amend our basic health program blueprint. So the amendments and the waivers are for the Medicaid program. The basic health program blueprint is what authorizes our Minnesota care program. And some of those were to temporarily expand what we allowed to be covered and paid for enrollees for related to telehealth services. And so within the agency, we worked really closely between our healthcare administration and our behavioral health division to really try to keep our keep alignment as best we could so that providers were getting consistent messages. We were creating consistent requirements, particularly our larger health systems that probably go across the spectrum would have some consistency in the expectations around what they could do, the standards around that, and the way that those services were billed. So we were really looking at the immediate needs, recognizing that people were going into stay-at-home orders. We had elective services were suspended for a time period. But how could we make sure that emergency healthcare services, primary healthcare services, specialty healthcare, and treatment services for opiate use disorder, substance use disorder, and mental health services would continue for people who needed them, particularly during the initial phases. Next slide, please. So within that, there's some vernacular that probably needs a little bit of clarification. So for background, there's sometimes you will hear things referred to as telehealth, and sometimes you'll hear a term telemedicine. Telehealth is a broader set of services and techniques that one can use. So it's use of electronic information and telecommunications to support clinical healthcare, but it also includes administrative services, some services that are not clinical treatment services. So it includes some of the same technologies support telehealth, but it's a broader set of services that might be provided. Telemedicine is a subset of telehealth, which is really specifically referring to remote clinical services, primarily including treatment services delivered to people. So just to make sure that people understand when we speak about those terms, what we're referring to. Next slide, please. So as our healthcare administration and our behavioral health division were making all of these changes, we decided that we really wanted to look at what was happening and what was the impact on people, how were providers responding, just to get a sense of what was going on, what was working, and where were things maybe not working. And we started to realize this was an opportunity to understand, at least in this really unprecedented situation, where was telehealth really being used, how was it being used, and how were patients feeling about using that. So we examined, and I want to stress this, our results are very preliminary. There is so much data yet to come in. We only have limited claims data to work with. So these are very early results, but we wanted to share them with the community as quickly as we could, because we understand that this should be a growing body of information that we continue to build on. So our experience really looked at March, where the stay-at-home orders and the expansions began. And our claims data and our analysis really covers through about June of 2021, although we've gained, there are a few things in our study that go beyond that date. We really limited our focus to treatment services within the physical health and behavioral health space. So long-term services and supports and case management services were outside of the scope of the study that we did. Although they expanded as well in telehealth, the study doesn't really speak to those particular services. And as I said, we were looking to see what providers and services were happening. How were providers ramping up services? Could they provide their services through telemedicine? And then how did that evolve as the situation on the ground changed? And so we applied four different methods. We did review of what literature may have been out there, particularly literature around what was going on during the pandemic. The second method we used was we had tons of community partners who were doing the same, wondering the same things we were. Is this working? Is this good? Should we be doing this? Should we be doing more of this? Is this not a good thing to continue? So we had many providers and organizations doing their own surveys. So rather than us doing another survey, recognizing that providers were already stretched thin and that patients were just trying to figure out how to get services, we simply ask, can we look at all of your surveys and compile and consolidate perhaps some of that information and share that back with the community? So that was the second method. The third, we took our claims from managed care and fee-for-service and just looked at what we could derive from our claims data. And then finally, we did some focus groups with providers to hear directly from them about their experiences and their perceptions of the experiences of their patients or information they were gathering through questionnaires from patients that they were serving. Next slide. So method one, which was the review of the literature, no surprise here, COVID-19 was a catalyst for telehealth. It expanded it rapidly and in ways that probably we had never thought it could, which was not a bad thing. So the good news is this wasn't all negative. It certainly ensured that people, when they couldn't get out to get services, or perhaps facilities were wanting to reduce their amount of staff, reduce the risk to their staff, that they could provide services remotely and prevent people from having to come into socially close situations. So it certainly enhanced the ability to get timely access to care. It also created more efficiencies. So patients didn't have to get in the car and drive long distances. If the provider was typically far away, it was efficient for patients to be able to fit appointments perhaps into their day much easier. Likewise for providers who normally would visit multiple sites could remain in one place and simply remotely connect with those sites. So there were certainly efficiencies that were gained. Within that, though, there, of course, is always concern that a one-size-fits-all doesn't work for all. And so there are certain populations that kept coming to light that we really do need to spend some time making sure that this does work. And in particular, seniors came out consistently, and in particular, their familiarity with technology and the comfort level with technology. Low-income individuals, their ability to have smartphones. Do they have smartphones? Do they have internet access? And so does that get in the way? Rural areas. Yes, it's good to have the distance, but you don't want to create access in rural areas that relies solely on telemedicine. There are services that still need to be done in person. And so how do we make sure that we're preserving that access in rural areas for people where that is the way the service should be performed? Individuals with pre-existing health conditions. Does this really work, or are we missing things? Will there be long-term impacts to people who maybe an in-person visit would have served them better? And then, of course, anyone with limited internet access, which rural areas are in particular, but we know that our tribal areas do not have internet access. We know some areas in larger communities don't have sufficient internet access. So that's just another consideration. And then just generally, this rapid expansion means we need to take some time to figure out what the long-term outcomes are. And that patient's health outcome at least hopefully improves. Does it stay the same, or did this do something detrimental to long-term outcomes? And those are things we just have to study over time. But then also that all healthcare providers should benefit if their services can be safely and effectively provided. There isn't probably a reason to keep certain providers from delivering services this way if their services can be appropriately provided. Next slide. And method two, which was the consolidation of the survey information. So this was coming from our local providers within Minnesota. And generally the information was really quite consistent with what the available literature and information was telling us on a more national level. But within some of the things that we heard specifically within Minnesota was that there's definitely a support for continued use of telehealth as an option. For provision of some services. I think there were some that worked really well, some that providers maybe felt would be a little bit, people could have been better served, or certain populations might be better served still doing it in person. But they did say you really have to look at the type of service, the frequency and the amount, and how often is that person receiving in-person care, so that you're not relying perhaps solely on telehealth as the only. The patient's preference, their comfort level. Do they feel connected? Do they feel like the experience is working for them? And then definitely, as we learn more about the long-term impacts, we need to inform our telemedicine policies in the future with that information as we learn it. And then finally, one of the things that I think everybody kind of in the healthcare world understands is one of the biggest reasons we could expand and that providers could expand, particularly in some sectors, was because there's been a relaxation in the enforcement of the privacy and security requirements under HIPAA. So the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which created those standards in the early 2000s, they are relaxing enforcement right now on those. And so we're allowing technologies that probably wouldn't meet the standard under normal circumstances, they're allowed to use those during the pandemic. And after the pandemic, we're not sure yet what that's enforced by the Office of Civil Rights and what the Office of Civil Rights may or may not do with respect to enforcement or changes to HIPAA, we don't know yet. And so if they go back to the pre-pandemic standard, there are providers who probably are not using compliant technologies. Next slide.
And Ms. Marquardt, if I could just for a moment, and members, first of all, I'm taking back the virtual gavel. Thank you to those who helped in my absence. And I see that Representative Pryor has her hand up. Representative Pryor, did you want to ask a question now or do you want to wait till the end?
Sorry, I can wait till the end.
All right, very good. And I just have a real quick question, Ms. Marquardt. When do you think we would know about the federal, what you were just mentioning about HIPAA and whether the waivers, is this something that we don't know when we'll know, or is there some time for that?
Madam Chair, I think we don't know. It's not even something that, because it's not even coming out of CMS, it's enforced by a different section. They just kind of announced their their changes and they don't really telegraph a whole lot. At least they didn't when they relaxed these. So I think it's on everybody's mind nationally. So the hope is that, you know, maybe there's some changes that could be made, but I don't think we know when or what.
Okay. And please continue with your presentation and then we'll hold all the questions. Sorry to interrupt you. We'll hold the rest of them until the end. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the last thing I'm going to present and then turn it over to Nirja is we just wanted to share with you the community partners that were working with us, that were doing surveys, that we were talking to, and that we all had an interest in the space. And I can't thank these partners enough. We really have been collaborating with them, and they have been giving us invaluable information. And so we really want to make sure we're sharing that back. And that we're kind of building this together. So we just wanted to give a shout out to our community partners here. And I will turn it over to Nirja.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Marquardt, and appreciate this big topic for us this year. And Nirja Singh, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead, introduce yourself and go ahead with your part of the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Nirja Singh, and I am the Clinical Behavioral Health Director for Community Support Administration. So I will be taking on where Julie left. This is like method third that we used in our study, and as you'll see, members and Madam Chair, there was like a significant increase in utilization of telemedicine. And when we're looking at this data, I just want to kind of give a word of caution that this is simply the providers who were telling us whether they were seeing the client in their office or not in their office. So we really do not know the exact modality of telemedicine they were using, like whether it was audiovisual, whether it was HIPAA compliant, whether it was telephone only. So this is simply that they were not seeing the patient in person and utilizing other modalities. Next slide, please. This is again, like, this is what we found in our analysis of our claims. And Madam Chair and members, as you'll see, that there was a quite low utilization of telemedicine modalities among our BIPOC communities. So as Julie mentioned, that this is an ongoing process. So we will be looking at possible reasons why our communities of color and our indigenous clients did not utilize telemedicine in the same manner as our white clients. Next slide, please. These are some of the themes that emerged out of our focus group discussions. And as you'll see, we really could not tell like the modality the providers were using. However, all providers agreed that they were able to significantly scale up their operations during COVID, which was a great news, so that our enrollees were able to get services during this pandemic. And as you see, like it really rated, it seems to be ideal for young to middle-aged adults who had some fluency with utilization of technology. Seniors and children, they really face a major, like a lot of obstacles in accessing that service. During our focus group, providers also expressed that it was difficult to engage children in calls for extended period of time, which really interfered with the level of service that children need. However, substantially, our providers were able to see that this telemedicine really helped with their clients' issues with mobility or like sometimes travel restrictions, so they were able to get the services. Next slide, please. These are some of the recommendations that came from the focus groups we did with providers, as well as our analysis of the surveys. So our providers are asking for clear guidance from DHS on billing, payment, patient notes, or any other aspects of care. And as Ms. Marquardt pointed out, right now, everything is up in the air because Nat and Sharon members, we were hoping when we put these waivers in place that the COVID will be over and we will have like a post-contagion group to compare, and we really don't. So it's an ongoing process, and we'll have to just learn as we go along. Majority of our providers have asked help to ensure access to high-speed internet. We are working and finding out some resources and how to even address this need. Also, like a lot of our requirements still need our patients as well as guardians of our patients if they are children for like signatures, like physical signatures. So providers, especially our small providers, really struggled in finding ways to obtain electronic signatures. We were able to waive, or we are looking at waiving some of the requirements for even electronic signatures and documenting if verbal consent can work, but that is like, it requires a lot of interface with the federal laws. And again, providers are asking us to work with CMS, which we are, to find out what would be an easy HIPAA compliance, because all our providers really care about patients' confidentiality and patients feeling at ease that when they're talking to their provider, the information is secure. But they want us to work with CMS and Office of Civil Rights to find out like what would be an easy way to ensure this adherence to HIPAA requirements. And then also, there was discussion regarding our clients where English is not the first language and there is need for interpreters, like how this would work for our communities, and which is still an ongoing consideration. Next slide, please. Madam Chair and members, we want to make sure, we cannot emphasize enough that this is one little step in the direction of ensuring and facilitating access to quality services in Minnesota. We have not, and our Medicaid, National Medicaid Directors is a group, and that group has strongly encouraged all the states to go to our Medicaid enrollees. Like this study has not talked to a single client because we have to go through different procedures to contact our clients. But we really want to explore and meet with our clients who received telemedicine during COVID to analyze their quality of care experience. What was their experience? Were they satisfied? This is very much limited to claims data. And as like kind of, you know what, as I explained in the beginning, we are still in pandemic. So it is so hard to really identify what specific variables telemedicine is going to be impacting on our delivery of our services. Because COVID has posed unique challenges for our enrollees as well as for our providers, loss of jobs. taking care of six family members, all those issues. So it's really hard to just kind of pinpoint at, okay, you know what, this telemedicine has made huge difference in lives of people. We don't know that. We had like very limited resources. It was just two administrations coming together because we wanted to continue working on analyzing the impact and ways to increase the efficacy of our services. But as I said, this is the beginning. There is so much unknown in this field. Telemedicine is great, but it does not work for everyone. And it does not work for every service modality. I am a practicing clinician, and I can just kind of imagine, like, for some of the services, it would be like, you know what, you are doing a check-in, you are doing a clinical symptom check. You could do it over the phone. However, when you are conducting like deep diagnostic assessments, when you're providing therapy for complex trauma issues, which we are really worried that coming out of COVID, people will have a lot of trauma issues, it is really hard to provide that without having visual interaction with the client. In addition, the sense of loneliness that our enrollees are reporting. It's really hard for people to be continuing to be getting these services on phone once this pandemic is over. So we would really want to continue looking at it, understand the efficacy, and bringing these resources to our people. I think that's our last slide. That's our recommendations for next step. I just covered it. So we would be conducting additional focus groups that is ongoing. We will be conducting efficacy studies on utilization of telephone only, because that was like a huge waiver we were able to get, which really helped people get services during pandemic. So that was great. So we really want to explore that further and see the limitations and what kind of guidance we will need if telephone stays at post-pandemic era. And then most important thing is we want to reach out to our enrollees. We want to reach out to our Medicaid and Minnesota Care enrollees to gauge their experience, because they are going to be our real judges of the effectiveness of this service. So with that, I'm going to open it up for questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. We really appreciate that. Very, very interesting. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, thank you for the presentation. And very, it's very heartening to know that already people are looking at and making sure that we're capturing the data, because we know that this has been something significant. And we certainly identify with this whole idea of telemedicine as we sit here on Zoom doing telecommittees. And there's advantages and disadvantages. So it's very appropriate to have this discussion, I think, at this point, while we're still in this virtual reality. The question that one of the things that came up, and I don't think it was, you know, maybe it's not appropriate to be looking at it at this point in your data gathering. It was not appropriate, but that it's going to be a question coming up, which is when you find these very appropriate uses for telemedicine in the future that could, you know, being patient-centered is something that works for patients. Is there a difference in cost? Would we reimburse at the same rates that we are right now, or, you know, is there an additional cost as you upgrade what's available through these other channels of delivering medicine, or is it a lower cost? And so I don't go in with the idea that, oh, it should be cheaper, but that is that something that you think that you'd be able to even access at this point, or is there a way of you know, putting out a plan of understanding where we should be going and how that's going to impact the cost of delivering this care?
So is that from Ms. Marquardt, perhaps, or I don't know who's more appropriate to answer. Thank you, Ms. Marquardt.
I can respond to that. Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, that's a very good question, and one we are also asking. Currently, we are paying the same as if the service had occurred in person. And there's, you know, lots of good reasons for doing that right now, given that, right, everybody had to turn on a dime, people had to purchase software, they, you know, everybody had to set things up. But I think mm-hmm. your question is really well founded in that over time, once those are in place, as we said, you know, in the review of the literature, there's efficiencies to some of this. So yes, I think there's investments. I mean, we talked about investments in broadband and investments in perhaps platforms that can be shared, which would also make it more efficient. Those are really good things that I think we would love to support. But I do want to point out too that, you know, telephone, which I think Nirja kind of touched on, is not telemedicine, right? So someone picking up the phone and doing that is not actually generally considered. We are considering it telemedicine during this pandemic. I think there are lots of questions about whether telephone should actually be reimbursed at the same level as an in-person visit. And I think that's a valid concern that all state Medicaid programs have right now, because that probably isn't. There are so many things you can't do when you can't visualize someone, let alone touch them. That you really are limited, and are you doing the same service then at that time? And we have seen that CMS has created on the physical health side some specific codes just for telephone, and they don't pay as high as if you do the evaluation and management service in person. So we don't know if that trend will continue, if they'll create telemedicine codes. You know, there's a lot of unknowns, and I do think we will get some information from some providers who we do get their costs. We do actually get cost detail information. That'll take probably another year and a half to 2 years before they have those final cost reports, but we will get some information from some providers on the actual costs.
All right, thank you. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is around HIPAA compliance. That was mentioned a couple of times, and I wonder if you could just briefly maybe talk about that a bit of what, in what ways is that not being followed, or is that specific to the platforms that are used, or can you just talk a little bit more about what that looks like in practice and perhaps what would need to be changed to make those practices become compliant?
Ms. Marquardt, is that one for you also?
Sure. Yeah, Madam Chair. The main aspects that are being not enforced right now are generally around the security requirements. So is the technology hardened enough that it can't be infiltrated? We had lots of providers who already had HIPAA compliant systems and they continue to use them. But for providers who maybe didn't use this method, I don't think they could just stand up a HIPAA compliant platform. So generally speaking, it's the hardening of the security around it and then the ability to do audit trails. There are requirements in HIPAA that require that you maintain the session data, which is just the technology behind the scenes of when did it start, when did it end, which IP address were you connecting to and where was that located, so that you could actually validate that the service occurred and that it occurred at the place that they said they were. Those kinds of things are what's being relaxed on enforcement. They still apply, it's just violations are not being.
Okay. Other questions, members? All right, I'm not seeing any. I just have a couple of comments, and unfortunately I missed the very beginning, but the fact that these are recorded is gonna save me here because I'm gonna go back and watch the entire hearing. But a couple things really jump out at me from the presentation. And one is the complexity of this whole issue. And some of the really great member questions kind of put a spotlight on that too, that we have to think about, you know, what should be paid for? Which things do we want to, obviously when you pay for something, you incentivize it. That's kind of one of those truisms of our work here, right? And so if we're paying, for example, for telephone visits, are we gonna get more telephone visits? Or, you know, all of the complexities that you talked about, there's just a lot to consider here. So I really appreciate that how the the report kind of unpacks some of this and helps us think about the different issues involved in it. That's really important. The other thing that really strikes me is sort of the timeline of this. So there are some bills circulating right now that will, you know, may or may not be go through this committee that are about this issue, what we should do with telemedicine, how we should, you know, pay for it. What should we to kind of make permanent some of the things that we've been doing temporarily during COVID. And so one thing that kind of struck me from the presentation is that, and you know, this is just for all of us to think about, that perhaps we're not really ready, and perhaps we won't be ready for a while to sort of make these decisions on a permanent basis. And so, you know, I think that we as legislators, we want to do the best for our constituents, which is the patients who are utilizing these services or could be utilizing them. We want to make sure that we're doing our duty to the state by making sure that we manage our budget and we don't pay for the wrong things or too much for the wrong things, and that we do pay enough for the right things. And, you know, so this is a really heavy responsibility for us. There's a ton of money, as you all know. You've heard all these presentations about how much money we spend on health services. It's a lot. So this is important. We need to get this right. And I guess what I'm saying here is I'd really love members to kind of help think about what our strategy should be for this session. And I'm thinking that maybe our strategy ought to be that we do something to extend some things on a temporary basis while we continue to collect some of this data, especially, God willing, when the COVID emergency is over and things start to get back, you know, where people can go in for visits more and see how some of these things play out so we get some more answers before we put permanent solutions in place. So I'm just putting that on the table for members to really think about, because this is one of the more complex and sort of weighty responsibilities that we have this session. And I think members also see that the session, the funnel is sort of really starting here as we get closer to deadlines, and we're going to have to make some very momentous decisions in a very short amount of time. So anyway, Representative Pryor, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for recognizing again, because I realized I had my turn, but I'm kind of, you know, very much hearing what you're saying and appreciate your comments there. And I want to add to it, based on the presentation, I think what Ms. Marquardt did mention is that it was talking to providers and not, you know, it just didn't have the opportunity yet to talk to the people receiving the care. And so for me, that's a huge driver of you know, what that's such a central part of this question and this complexity that we have to look forward to. Because I know, you know, anecdotally, I would say my mother had a small stroke and she was visiting with the professional, the expert in the field through telemedicine. And that was the best medicine for her to have that conversation and not have to drive to a different city to do it. So I guess as we, you know, move forward and think permanently what should be in place, that we begin with, you know, what was the experience of the people receiving the care, and make sure that that's definitely part of the conversation going forward. And I can see where we're not going to solve all of this before the end of this budget session. It's good. Good words of wisdom. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah,
thank you, Representative Pryor. And let me just ask Ms. Marquardt and Ms. Singh, if you sort of what the plan is for continued study. Now, I know you said in the presentation that it's difficult because we had all hoped that we were going to have the emergency be over and then there'd be some comparisons that could be made. And obviously that hasn't happened. And although we hope that we're seeing it happen fairly soon, but is there a plan for any sort of more formal evaluation, or not more, but, you know, formal evaluation of some of these issues that we'll be able to look to? Is that something that perhaps the legislature's partnership is needed to be able to provide the ability to do that? Because there's an awful lot at stake here for patients, for the state, for everybody.
I can take that, Madam Chair, and then Ms. Margaret can add. Well, the next step, we already have provider focus groups going on, asking them regarding utilization of telephone only. As I said in my presentation, like how providers were able to or not able to address complex behavioral health concerns, like I said, complex trauma or severe grief issues using telephone only, because it's not possible. We all know that without seeing the patient that you can treat some of those areas. So we are, those focus groups are going on right now. We are working to submit a request to our research board to develop a plan, because we need to go through our IRB board to conduct these focus groups with our Medicaid enrollees. So we will be reaching out to Medicaid enrollees too, asking about their experience of care with telemedicine and different modalities of telemedicine, audiovisual, as well as use of telephone only. So those are like two broad areas that DHS at this time will be going into. And of course, we will need, as both Julie and I mentioned, like it was just our two divisions coming together and just kind of pulling stuff. So yes, we will need a lot of support and resources to do it right. Because again, it's an ongoing process. It's not an end. As like we have new challenges, we'll continue to explore those. And I can only speak for behavioral health, and Julie can just speak of overall healthcare, like what are the plans there. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Marquardt. Did you want to add anything to that?
Madam Chair, yes, I just had one thing to add. In addition to what Ms. Singh said, which is, the first we want to talk to enrollees. That's critically important, to understand their experience and understand that, when everything's closed down and I have to stay home, maybe something was better than nothing, but if I have the option, maybe I'd rather, or maybe for some people, this was right up their alley and they love it. And we just need to know. And I think the other thing that we didn't, is in the slides, but we probably didn't highlight well enough, was we really need to talk to providers with who provide culturally competent care, that we really talk to different racial and ethnic groups that are represented to make sure that all of these modes, number one, work. If they need interpreters, does that work? If it doesn't, could it work? And what would that have to look like? But then also ensure that we don't create a two-tiered system either. We don't want to incentivize that low-income folks in Minnesota receive care that looks very different. So we also want to stay in touch with the rest of the healthcare payer community and provider community, that everyone has access to the services that work for them. Whether you're high income, low income, we don't want to get too far away or too far different from each other. So we also want to stay really connected to the broader payer groups in Minnesota too.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Marquardt. I'm going to call on Representative Kwan, but I just want to say that one of my many concerns about how we move forward here is that, I don't want to have telemedicine so replace brick and mortar providers, if that's the right way to say it, that say we don't have networks anymore in greater Minnesota. So if there's no, right now it's already, we don't have enough mental health professionals, especially in greater Minnesota. And I would hate to have it be, oh, well, you can call someone on the phone, so we don't need any there. I that's a bit of a concern that I have, that it would act as a, disincentive for, especially for payers, to make sure that, that they're doing what they need to do to keep providers actually in more remote areas of the state. Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, and you and I remember the great Karnak, and in your mind, I'm reading augment. So that telemedicine should augment the accessibility. I see the community paramedic was a form in which we augmented the normal healthcare providing, and we assisted outside of the major cities. We earlier discussed non-emergency medical transport, and a lot of that involves possibly things we could look at doing some telemedicine. Minnesota is a net, the best way to put it, there are more patients that live outside Minnesota that have care inside Minnesota than most states. And because of that, some of our healthcare providers have been ahead of the curve in, you know, pre-screening or contact away from the main facility. And part of the question is, what are the federal things enabling us to do what we need to do for telehealth and the other augmentations we're doing? And at some point after the budget is done, it'd be nice to have some sort of a presentation of the current state of cooperative medical care across the country and how that impacts, and do we have to have enabling language, you know, and et cetera. Because I think telehealth, like many things, have been pushed forward by the pandemic. And, you know, we're doing, you know, distance work, et cetera. So I'm excited for the possibilities. I know that you got to watch where you step. I grew up on a farm. And, you know, frankly, we got to be careful, but let's move forward because we've got players in the state that are very anxious to take us to the next steps. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to recenter on the possibilities of telehealth. I feel like the conversation's turned a little negative because I do think this is one of the silver linings, if there can possibly be a silver lining of the pandemic. We've learned that this is an incredible opportunity to expand patient access to care. It expands patient choice. It saves patients money. I see it as a very patient-centric improvement in many cases. So we have to do it right, and I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation, but I think there's a lot of positivity and a lot of hope about the possibilities of real progress that telehealth can bring us.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Morrison. No, I agree. I think that's, thank you for that. I think that's been very clear. And, you know, there are things that we need to work on to make sure that it, that we do it right. But absolutely, I don't think anyone's talking about, let's go back to where we were. I think that the real question is, how can we best go forward? So anyway, other questions, members, or comments? We have 3 minutes. All right, not seeing anybody. So thank you all very much. We appreciate the presentations. Thank you very much for that work. And so members, I just want to let you know, here's talk about bad news. We're adding a hearing this week on Friday from 3 to 4:30, and we're gonna be doing additional hearings on Fridays 3 to 4:30. So block that out on your calendar. We're getting to that time of year, and you know, we just have to make sure that we get through the things we need to before deadlines. So the next meeting is tomorrow. We're gonna be hearing a bill from Representative Ryer and a bill from, so we're gonna be hearing House File 363. We're gonna be hearing House File 1000 from Representative Schultz, and then House File 1139, which is mine. So with that, members, thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.